Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. This time, award-winning authors and friends, Carla Kaplan and Amanda Vail, interview each other about their latest books. Kaplan's Troublemaker, The Fierce, Unruly Life of Jessica Mitford, and Vail's Pride and Pleasure, The Shuler Sisters in an Age of Revolution, were published in 2025, respectively by Harper and Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Both books were shortlisted in December of last year for the National Book Critics Circle Awards. Amanda Vail will be the first voice you'll hear in this fascinating conversation.
Carla, it is so exciting to be celebrating the publication of Troublemaker with you and having this conversation about our subjects who, despite the 200 years between them almost, have so many similarities. The first similarity that they have is that the Schuyler sisters and the Mitford sisters, Becca Mitford, both came from moneyed upper-class families, and there was this expectation that they would marry moneyed upper-class people and be ornaments to society, and that's what they would do with their lives, and they went a different way.
Yeah.
Here we are, we're both friends, each of us working on these books forever, and we never had this conversation.
I know, and it's kind of amazing how much crossover there really is between my book and your wonderful book, Pride and Pleasure, and it's so much fun to talk about them together, because even though these women are separated by not quite 200 years, but they're separated by enormous amount of time, they are all getting the same message, which is that the way you're going to matter in the world is you're going to marry an important man. This is how you're going to be significant. And in a certain way, they each do it. And in a certain way, they all completely skirt that script.
The men they end up choosing, weirdly, are kind of like a bridge.
Yeah, the men are very much a bridge. I mean, for Jessica Mitford, who I will refer to always by her chosen name of Decca, for Decca, her first husband was very much her bridge and her education and her channel. She had grown up in this right-wing aristocratic family and historical throwback. I can't think of a family that would be more like the Schuyler family 160 years later than the Mitfords. They were insular, they were moneyed, they were landed, they were off by themselves, they hardly mixed with other people. Her father was in Parliament, but he was a minor member of Parliament on the Plumbing and Drains Committee. Philip Schuyler was much more prominent. You know, they grow up in this isolated way, raised for the marriage market. And almost all her sisters follow that model. They follow it in odd ways. But Diana, you know, marries first Brian Guinness, heir to the biggest liquor fortune in Europe, and then leaves him for Oswald Mosley, of all horrible choices, founder of the British Union of Fascists. Unity goes chasing after Hitler. Debo marries a duke, which is how she achieves her goal of becoming a duchess. And at first, it looks like Decca is going to a little bit follow that model on the left, because Esmond Romilly is a socialist. He's already a rebel. He has fought in the Spanish Civil War. He's going to give her an education.
But he's very aristocratic.
He's very aristocratic. He's related to Winston Churchill. He's Winston Churchill's nephew.
Yeah.
But it's after his death that she really comes into her own as a political thinker, as an agent. She starts working. So one of the questions I have for you is, how did the marriages of the sisters, and I suppose we can include the mother, enable and also disable their ability to act as agents and as women both?
Well, you know, Angelica Schuyler Church, as she became, was so desperate to get, I think, to get out of Albany during the revolution that she grabbed the first man she could see that looked like he was her ticket out. He's an accountant. He's doing work in her father's account books. He's literally monitoring his accounts. But he's a Londoner. He's come to America to fight for the revolution. He seems exotic and interesting. He's done all of these cool things. He's fought a duel, he tells her.
Right.
But nobody knows who his family is. And so Philip Schuyler disapproves of him and will not allow him to pay his addresses to his eldest daughter. And that is all that Angelica needed to hear. She immediately thinks, you tell me no, and I'm going to do what I want. She's a very rebellious girl. She runs off with him. They elope. In the end, it turns out he makes a bundle as a war profiteer and takes her off to London when the war is over. He goes back to England and wants to be in Parliament. And she helps him get himself elected by kind of sucking up to the right people and manipulating society in such a way that he's got political debts that he's owed because of her graciousness. And so she becomes that kind of political manipulator, behind the scenes kingmaker person. Meanwhile, her little sister marries a guy that she meets at a dance when she's visiting her uncle and aunt in Morristown, New Jersey. And this guy not only has no money, he is not only does he come from the West Indies, not only does he have absolutely no connections at all, he is illegitimate.
Right.
And she falls madly in love with him and he with her, and they want to get married right away. And weirdly, her father, who objected to John Church, who married Angelica, thinks that Alexander Hamilton is absolutely wonderful. And I find that fascinating because I think Philip Schuyler saw this guy, his intellect, his ambition, they were things that he prized. And his daughter sees these qualities too, and she wants them.
But it's a
She
very
wants them.
striking difference, right? Because Hamilton is less socially situated than Angelica's husband, and yet he has absolutely nothing except clearly his genius, clearly his political chops, his incredible ambition, right?
And he uses this to become friends with all the people that the Schuylers are friends with. So immediately she becomes a doorway for him to walk through, which she's thrilled by. She wants to help him do that. It's fascinating to me. These women find these guys who are totally the wrong guys. They are not at all the people that their parents would ever have wanted for them. But they think, first of all, they love them. They are strongly attracted to them, which is, I think, also interesting in and of itself. This is not an arranged marriage in any way. This is something where they're really acting on eros,
Oh, clearly, especially Eliza
Oh.
and Hamilton, right? I mean, it's clearly a very sexualized union,
Yeah.
right?
And well, and the thing that I think is so charming when Decca runs off with Esmond, at first, they're being kind of just like, the kids have run off to war
Right.
together, but then they fall in love.
Well, and that takes
Oh.
about 3 days to go from being sort of comrades to being lovers. And he was absolutely the great love of her life. And yet, her second husband, Robert Truhaf, was a brilliant choice for her and was incredibly enabling of her as an agent, as a writer, as an activist. This is something I was going to ask you about the sisters and their marriages, because one of the things that's really striking about Decca's second marriage to Robert Truhaf was very unconventional by gender terms. From almost day one, he took over all of the shopping, all of the cooking, and all of the house cleaning. She never was interested in learning, but it really is an extremely modern marriage. And it's not just that he takes over all the domestic chores. He's really interested in her being the one to get all the credit, to have the microphone. People don't know that American Way of Death was completely co-written by the two of them, but he lets her take all the credit. She has the byline, And that is the shape of their marriage for the rest of their lives. So one of the reasons she is able to shine as an activist and then have this breakout phenomenal success as a writer is she has what's actually a very feminist marriage. So what would you say about the Schuyler sisters' marriages?
You know, they both have, in some senses, rather conventional marriages in that the husband does the thing and the wife does not take obvious credit for the thing, whatever it is. But in Angelica's case, you know, she is the social ornament. She is the one who is having the dinner parties, inviting the people, charming the Prince of Wales so that he will look kindly on John Church's political career and he will then be get advancement in Parliament. So there's all that going on. She only really steps out from behind him once, which is in her ill-fated attempt to get Lafayette sprung from prison during the French Revolution. And in this case, what she does is she uses his money to pay people to try to spring him. She gets two henchmen to go and try to just get him out of prison. And this is done with the secret connivance of the American ambassador to Britain, which is totally, totally not legit because America had a non-intervention policy during the French Revolution. They were officially neutral. But she's doing all of this secretly. But do you know what's so interesting? That no one ever gave her the credit for this because they would say that it was him, that it was his money. So he did it. But I found all these letters between her and the other actress in the drama, which show that it actually was her. Now, Eliza is a whole other case because she's acting as Hamzon's sort of backstop. She acts as a sounding board for him. He reads stuff to her. She says, no, that doesn't sound like it's going to fly. You should do this. She reads books for him. Interestingly, there are a number of very, very weighty and incredibly dense economic histories of the ancient world, which she seems to have read for him in preparation for his drafting the memoranda that's led to the founding of the Bank of the United States in 1791. Her name is on the fly leaf of these books. So, you know, I'm thinking here's this woman who was the world's worst speller. And everyone always thought she was kind of illiterate because she could spell. But she's not illiterate. She's reading these damn books and talking to him, saying, well, you know, in ancient Assyria, they did X. You need someone to do that. That's the kind of marriage that she had with him. She was like his assistant and pushed him forward that way.
One of the things that is an interesting parallel, 160 some years apart, is that these women we're talking about, Decca in my case, the sisters in yours, had ways of using their marriages, channeling their marriages to have agency on their own. But they were also, each of them, parts of these very intense sisterhoods. Decca's sisterhood is just famous. The Mitford sisters are one of the most famous sisterhoods in English literature. They're often referred to as a tribe, sometimes as a savage little tribe. Decca learned an enormous amount from her sisters. I believe that all the games and the pranks and the secret languages and the play actually were embedded by her into her writing, and that it's why her writing feels so familiar and intimate and chatty that she sort of took the girl's conversation into her writing style. So I think she learned an enormous amount from her sisters. In fact, she also learned how not to be. Her sisters really tried to have both unconventional lives but conventional marriages, except for Pamela, whose wife, as Decca called her, was a woman. So you can't really call that a very conventional marriage
True.
for the
And what about
time.
Unity?
But Unity, who didn't have a marriage at all, was sort of wedding herself in almost religious devotion to Hitler. I mean, all of these women, Nancy, who wasn't married, put herself as a subordinate under the thumb of a man who could not love her and left her for somebody wealthier, Gaston Paluski. They were all very traditional in their romances, in their love relationships. And Decca looked at that and said, I'm not going to do that. She did it with Esmond, but then she stopped doing that. She had this very modern, untraditional marriage. And I think she learned that too from her sisters. So one of the sort of interesting things about the Schuyler sisters is how they learn from and use their husbands. but how they're also using that sisterhood, how they're using one another. Now, I know there's sometimes some rivalry.
Well, I think that's what's so interesting here is that Angelica was always, she always wanted to be a star. There's a real alpha girl quality that she has. And if she was a tennis player, she'd be the one who rushes the net. She rushes the net. And so Eliza is playing tennis with her, and she's a baseline player. So she goes back to the baseline, and she's just going to keep returning the ball back and forth. And that's what she does. And interestingly, when Eliza marries Hamilton, which she does after Angelica's elopement, Angelica meets this guy that Eliza has married and thinks, oh God,
That would have been the one, right?
my little sister got
Got
the
him.
hottie. How did that happen?
Yeah.
And she spends the rest of Hamilton's life really kind of trying to attract him with more or less success, depending on what you make of the documents that were left behind. And I think what this did was to really reinforce Eliza's playing that baseline game, but it kept her on her toes. Maybe she wouldn't have been so involved in Hamilton's political career. I don't know. But, as circumstances worked out, she was, and she really did try to foster it. And then, of course, after he died, she made him into an industry, collecting all of his papers and trying to get his biography written. But she also had this gigantic other career as a nonprofit executive, co-founding an orphanage, running it for 20 years.
Was that something that she did because he had been essentially orphaned?
She had been doing work with, there was a widows organization, which many of the people who worked in the orphanage association had been a part of, which she'd also been a volunteer for. And this was a really much more organized, much larger organization. And she started doing things like lobbying for funds and all of this, which is quite modern. And you kind of don't expect to see that. So her bereavement and her feelings about her orphaned husband, I think, helped her to this career in much the way that Decca is inspired by her husband to do what she does. I think also that happened to Eliza all those many years earlier.
Was a little bit inspired by, if you mean by her husband, you mean by Esmond. I think by the
I
time,
think by Bob.
I'm pretty sure by the time she meets Bob Truehaft, she really does have an agenda, and Bob is less an inspiration than a partner. And the other thing that he's so great about is he lets her deal with everything in her own way. So, she has a very particular way of being ambitious. She's super focused and super entrepreneurial, actually. She also has a very particular, very British aristocratic, concrete upper lip way of dealing with tragedy, which is she's not going to talk about it. She's not going to go there. She's going to move in the other direction, and she's just going to keep forging ahead and being busy. And Bob lets her do that. He's a great partner for her because I think he recognizes that she is as motivated by running from the tragedies behind her as she is by running towards any goal.
This is yet another thing that these women have in common. Not only that they found partners so different from what their families might have expected, and found through them strength in a platform and an agency and a way to be activist, they also had tragedy
Yeah, incredible
and
tragedy.
a family tragedy. I mean, they lost children. Angelica lost one child early in infancy and another later who died at 10, and she really adored her children. She liked to do things like play cards with them, and they would get up little children's dramas, and she would watch those. She loved that. And she was deeply, deeply fond of her kids. And this must have been devastating for her. I've absolutely no idea what her reaction was to it. And then, of course, Eliza had to endure the death of one of her sons in a duel 3 years before her husband is killed in a duel with the same set of pistols, which were owned by her brother-in-law, John Barker Church. And how do you go forward with this? Somehow she did, and Decca had the same thing.
Yeah. One of the things that's most interesting about her, most admirable, was for me, it took longest to understand and to get to know. Because it was always characteristic of Decca that she said least about what hurt her or mattered most. So her husband's death is one sentence in her memoirs, in her autobiography. Her son's death, Nicholas, her beloved son who was killed by a bus delivering newspapers, literally just a footnote. And she never mentions the death of her daughter. So she had a daughter who died in infancy from measles,
Measles, right, yeah.
largely because of misunderstandings about Decca's class background. She was living in a working class neighborhood. She had a public health nurse. The public health nurse assumed that she, like other working class women, had been exposed to lots of people and lots of measles. Decca didn't say, "No, I'm an aristocrat. We were insulated from everybody. We weren't allowed to play with other children. She had no exposure." So when she got measles and her daughter got measles, she almost died and her daughter died. It was very much connected to that class background. It was a terrible tragedy. She never spoke of it. She and Esmond ran away to Corsica for 3 months and they grieved together. They didn't let anybody see them grieve. When he died, almost no one saw her cry. She forged ahead by putting that pain behind her in a way that is very much not usual for American women. And it was a problem in some of her friendships. It was why some of her closest friends were frenemies, because they would come to her with their pain or their troubles or their heartache or their difficulties. And she would say, "Fundraise for the Montgomery bus boycott.
Go forward,
Yeah,
young.
just go for it." She called any interest in the self grubbing about. And she didn't want to be part of any grubbing about. And I grub about. So it was kind of hard to understand that about her. You know, I was raised to grub about. I was raised in the personal is political, right? So, you know, that was part of her strength, but I think it cost her really, really dearly.
You know, Eliza was clearly devastated when her son was killed because Angelica wrote a letter to her brother talking about how she's a little composed afterwards. But you get the sense that she was devastated. Eliza wrote to her brother, another brother, shortly after Hamilton's death saying, "I want to die. If I didn't have children who need to be nurtured, educated, and loved, I would just wish nothing more than that I would die, that I could go fly to my Hamilton and there rest forever." 4 months later, her brother is saying, "Well, I think you should sell this and that lot of land." She says, "No, actually, I don't think you should do that because the market is not good to sell right now. We should sell it." And I'm thinking, this woman has pulled herself together so quickly
Yeah.
because you had to. You know, back in the 18th century, people died all the time from all kinds of things. And I think, you know, the proximity to death, you might feel it as acutely, but it is so much more a part of life that you have no choice but to pull up your socks and go forward, which she did. And she was pretty damn good at it.
It's amazing to witness that because we don't have enough stories about that, enough stories about women who have that kind of toughness, you know, historically down through time. You know, we still lack so many stories of how women survived enslavement, survived war, survived famine, survived earthquake. And yet we know that they're not only the survivors, but often the ones pulling everybody else through, right? So this gives us these kinds of interesting stories.
What I find also so amazing is that my women are doing this. They are inventing a life where they have agency, where they have action. They are activists in their way. And they are doing this in the 18th century, in the early 19th century. And then 150 years go by, 100, whatever, however many, depending on where you start. And Decca has to start all over again. It's like she's reinventing the wheel.
And the connections are just amazing. Should we try asking each other like one or two lightning questions
Oh,
and see if we can get through a couple?
absolutely.
So let me give you one, my first lightning question for you. What one thing in the course of writing this book did you learn that you most want to pass on to a starting biographer?
Never let anybody tell you that there is no material.
Nice. So I will add to that. Never let anybody tell you there isn't material. And if you are making agreements or deals or getting permission, get everything in writing.
Everything.
Because these books take a long time. Amanda's took 7 years, I think. Mine took 10. And oh, 9 and 10. And over the course of that time, people change jobs, conditions change, get everything in writing. Okay, now you can ask me a lightning
All
question.
right, Dicka Mitford's favorite sister. Which of all the Mitfords is her favorite sister?
Well, I can tell you who was her favorite sister, and it's a heartbreak. But hands down, when they were young, her favorite sister was Unity. And even though later in life she cut Diana completely, in fact, she blamed Diana the fascist for her husband's death, fighting fascism in World War II. She never really spoke to Diana again, but she did correspond with Unity. Unity went into a park when England and Germany declared war, took a pistol out of her handbag, put it up to her temple, pulled the trigger, but she lived for 8 more years with diminished capacities. Although she remained rather devoted to Hitler during those 8 years, Decca wrote her letters, sent her little gifts. The sister she managed to be closest to was Debo, the Duchess, but it was a very strained relationship. They couldn't really show each other the truth of their lives. So my next not unconnected question for you is, who was your favorite sister?
It kind of went back and forth with me, and I will tell you in the end, I think Eliza is probably the one I would have liked to have been friends with because I think she was loyal and she was funny. They were all funny. They had a really droll sense of humor, these girls, and they would say funny things about other people that are in their own kind of private tone of voice. It's a very sisterly kind of thing. Angelica, who was so superficially charming and attractive and alluring, is kind of a sad person in the end because she kind of never really got what she most wanted, which was kind of, she really was in love with Hamilton and she could never have him. And I think she was disappointed in her husband who got to be fat and kind of loutish, and he was a gambler and played cards all the time, and it was not fun for her. And I just feel that things didn't quite turn out the way she wanted them to, but she made the best of it. And there's a kind of gallantry about that. So I love them both, but in very different ways.
One of the things I hear in the way you're talking about them is I hear that use of present tense. I hear how present they literally are to you. And it's, of course, one of my very favorite things in the book. But what I noticed in the audiobook, and I will tell people who are listening, you have to listen to the audiobook. It's quite surprising because Amanda has somehow pulled off having Pride and Pleasure read in two different voices. So the past, the historical voice is a man's voice, and the present, focused mostly on the sisters and their lives, is a female voice. How did you pull that off?
Hats off to Steve Wagner, the brilliant producer at Macmillan Audio. I said right away, he said, "Have you had any thoughts about who should narrate this?" And I said, "Well, there should be two narrators." And I could sort of hear this sort of, and I said, "Well, there are two different narrative voices in the book. And one of them is really sort of the male narrative. And that's the historic. And we're looking at that through the other end. We're pushing that in the background. And what's coming to the fore is the women's narrative, which is much more present tense. It is in the present tense." And he said, "Yes, okay."
Very unusual and quite wonderful. The audiobook is a
So great.
wonderful thing. It's
Well,
so great.
I'm so pleased because they were lovely and let me write dramaturgical memos about how things should be read and what were the sort of high points were. Authors never get allowed to do that, but they
No.
may, and which was
Oh,
very
that's
sweet.
great.
I'm very touched. I want to ask you, who would Decca have voted for in the 2024 presidential election?
Decca was, on the one hand, would have been a Sanders supporter by politics and by
Yes.
program. But the thing people need to understand about Jessica Mitford, a lifelong anti-fascist, communist, anti-authoritarian, she was a pragmatist. So I think that because she was such a committed anti-racist, I think she would have been a Harris supporter. I think she would have been a massive Harris campaigner. She campaigned for all kinds of Democratic candidates who she felt were the best shot to get through reforms. So on the one hand, she was a prison abolitionist. She may have coined the term prison abolition, but she was also highly pragmatic, and I think she would have campaigned for Harris.
Yay.
All right, this is going to have to be our last question,
Okay.
unfortunately. So you worked on people around the Schuyler sisters for whom there's a lot of established scholarship. Less on them. That was very much the work you had to do, was bringing them back into light and finding this incredible archive you find in Pride and Pleasure about them. But the men around them have quite a bit of historical, scholarly, biographical work that's been devoted to them over the years, not least of which Hamilton. So my question for you is, what one main point of difference do you take with some of the established scholarship that is out there?
That's a real goodie. I used to really revere Thomas Jefferson for many, many reasons. There were plenty of reasons to have an asterisk next to it, and Sally Hemings is the big reason for that. But what I did not realize was the extent to which Jefferson was, as revealed in the documents that I uncovered in looking for his connection to both Schuyler sisters and to Hamilton. Jefferson was the kind of guy who would say, James Madison, go and pick a fight with Alexander Hamilton. I'm not going to do it because I shouldn't get my hands dirty, but you do it. And the other thing he did is he was a terrible lech. I mean, just awful. He's making up to Angelica, and he bought her a multi-volume set of erotic engravings from Pompeii. And they are just absolutely mind-boggling. I have to tell you, they're the sort of thing that your mother would not have let you look at.
Where did you see them?
The
In the flesh?
books are referred to in a letter that Angelica writes to him saying, "Oh, there are two. I got two of volume seven, and could you just take back the one and get me the other one?" And he says, "No problem, I'll do it." And I thought, "I wonder what this book is that she's talking about." So I went to look it up. And that was when I found out these books that people, I suppose people have known for years that these books existed. They know the name, but I don't know how many people went to see what's actually in them. But I did, and I was so horrified. There are these things of, people fornicating in the god Priapus walking around with this gigantic phallus on a wheelbarrow and, stuff
Well,
like that.
that's one of the things that makes your book so rich and wonderful, is you went to look at everything, and you did look at everything, and it brings them completely to life.
Out.
And I just have to say how much I love your book.
I
Been.
love your book and how much I love Deca, the most wonderful woman. I actually wish that somehow I could have gotten all the Mitfords and all the Schuylers together. Can
Maybe
you
that'll be our next
imagine
project, is we'll have
that?
to animate them and somehow bring them back. Oh,
Imagine that.
that's a dinner party. If anybody out there listening hasn't read it, read the book.
Yep, we've written books about people that you really want to know.
You just heard veteran authors Carla Kaplan and Amanda Vail interviewing each other via Zoom about their latest books. Kaplan's Troublemaker, The Fierce, Unruly Life of Jessica Mitford, and Vail's Pride and Pleasure, The Schuyler Sisters in an Age of Revolution. Both biographies were published in 2025, and this session was recorded in November of last year. To learn more about Bio, or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. Ellian Marie Fillinganes created our theme music. Jenny Skoog is our producer. Carolyn Van Putten, assistant producer. And Shireen Newman is our engineer. I'm executive producer Sonia Williams. And until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a wonderful day.